You're listening to The Perth Property Show, Australia's only weekly property podcast by West Australian experts for West Australian listeners. Catch your latest episode every Monday at 7 a.m.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to The Perth Property Show. My name's Trent Fleskins, your host as always. This week, we're chatting with Aaron Seiss from the HIA on an update on where the medium density code has landed. It came back to the fore in the media about a month and a half ago, when suddenly after it was deferred in September for, in my opinion, pretty rational reasons based on its impingement on our ability to keep affordable supply going across the medium density space in Western Australia at the moment, in what's the most critical time we've seen in my lifetime, certainly. We're now in a position where we've heard from the government, from agencies saying, well, look, it's back on the table. We've had a look. We've rethought a few things. Here are some changes that we're going to be making to what people didn't like about it. But the specifics of it, we're talking to Aaron about today to give us a rundown on what's in, what's out, what the transitional periods are for going forward, how that will affect your application as a developer, and just generally how that will affect the way we're going to be building homes in the future in Western Australia in that medium density space. Aaron, thanks for coming in, mate.
Thanks for having me again.
Now, you are the nerd in this space. You really have taken
self-confessed nerd.
That's right. Real interest in the discourse, I think. And as part of the round table that Minister Kerry agreed to setting up, where it was HIA, there was the architects, the planners, everyone around that round.
Other industry associations. Yeah, there was a lot of different representatives.
A lot of people
were
having a conversation the second you pulled the rug from under this. There was a lot of hoo-ha, especially from the architects and the planners about, well, we were getting ready for this and we had a whole bunch of applications ready to go. You're killing supply in the space of the new types of builds that we were designing. Minister Kerry, what are you doing? Quickly, we want a dual code. We want to opt in, all these options to let that go. My understanding is the response was, yeah, look, let's have a conversation. I can appreciate there are some people that'd be unhappy about this, but the priority here is to make sure that we're not enacting a code that is going to rob Peter to pay Paul in terms of supply in Western Australia, and more specifically, affordable supply in the infill space. One thing that was the most apparent thing to me about this code last year when it was coming into the fore was that it was essentially mandating and forcing a less affordable type of infill product, two-story infills, townhouses, over single-story in most of the space because of the way that it started to restrict site coverage and impact on increased setbacks and outdoor spaces in these triplexes and duplexes and quads. That was a problem. That was a problem I raised with the minister. Listened, obviously, to myself and a number of people, and now we're trying to find a happy balance. So Aaron, can you give us a bit of color around that intro I've provided as to what is going to be happening on the 8th of April in terms of how it will affect an ability to lodge a development application in Western Australia?
Probably start from the big ticket items and work our way down to more granular items. Single houses from R30 and R40 have been removed from the scope of Part C, which is the medium density code. We're actually not allowed to call it the medium density code anymore. It's just Part B and Part C.
Well, it is the medium density code. We're talking about infill, right?
We're talking about
that
infill,
missing middle. And why do you think that's happened? Is that because the big land developers kicked up a big stink and said, well, we're developing single dwellings at R30 and R40 and our subdivisions on the fringes these days, you can't kill what we're doing? Is that
really single houses or freehold titles on master planned estates are a very different product to an infill type of development?
They're not infill, but they have the same zoning often these days.
Well, they will do. If you look at some of the inner peripheries like Dianella and Yokine, for example, they've got R30 through them versus R30 is now the default zoning. It's really taken over from R20 and R25 in greenfield estates.
So that's not infill, but it's still the same zoning. So what the argument was, well, you can't throw us in the same bucket.
They're effectively two different dwelling types. They've got different controls. They've got different issues at play. Mm. So to capture single houses in the same breath as something that really should be capturing something like a corner lot, it's being rezoned a split coding or to capture a house behind a house or a fourplex development or an amalgamated site with a shared driveway, you kind of got to ask the question, is it appropriate? Since meeting one, hour one, day one, HIA have always been opposed to R30 being within the scope of the code and R35. To have it extended to R40 probably recognises some of the more progressive infill typologies now that are talking to much smaller lot typologies around the 250 and what that represents, because often those lots are captured under an LDP anyway. There are certain things within the medium density code that you're not allowed to vary or there are some things that require planning commission approval to vary. And that includes for local schemes and LDPs alike from both ends of the spectrum. So it really was putting the cart before the horse. I'd say that with the idea that neighbourhood design, which is the livable neighbourhoods guidance document evolution as it continues, that's prescribing subdivision patterns and road widths and carriages and all kinds of things that affect subdivisions generally. So when you've got a code that might come before that, we really need neighbourhood design to talk to what subdivisions look like before we can start prescribing what's in those subdivisions as well. So I think that it was right to remove R30 and R40 and put them back to Part B until that work happens, and only for single houses, in the knowledge that that is coming, and then Part B will be revised anyway, I dare say.
Okay, so first big ticket item is that single dwellings in the R30, R40 space have been pulled out of this.
Yep.
If you're not in a single dwelling situation in your R40, you're still back into that medium density code Part C space. So let's say you've been put into Part C. How would your life be different now as someone lodging a development application compared to a couple of months ago?
It's going to be very different. You really need to review the code from scratch again. It reads a lot like the apartment code. The layout is very similar to the apartment code. So if you've been looking at volume 2, you'd be familiar with the graphics and the typologies and that kind of thing and where to find certain provisions. So that's a good thing. But there's also there's additional requirements that didn't exist previously. One of the big ones is a fairly large increase in the minimum courtyard area size.
This is huge. This will really impact the building parcels of the way we've been developing a triplex block, for example, in Nollamara, Warwick, Padbury, Coolbla, Willoughby.
Right.
What's the logic here?
The logic is that the smaller the lot, the smaller the courtyard. The larger the lot, the larger the courtyard. It's generally broken up into windows, like 100 to 120 square meters is a minimum of this size for your lot size, rather than code-based lot size. Whereas previously, for example, if you were doing an R30 outdoor living area or private open space or however you want to split it these days, it was 24 square meters. And you know off the top of your head that's what it was. But now it depends on the lot size. So for example, if you've got an R40 lot and it's 180, you might only be triggered into, say, 30 square meters of courtyard area, whereas if you're going to a 215 or a 220 square meter R40 lot, this is exclusive lot area, then you might be up to 35 square meters or even 40 square meters, depending on the lot size.
All of these numbers are larger than what they used
Much
to be.
Much larger.
What's the rationalisation?
Well, the rationalisation there is that setbacks have been reduced. So you've got front setbacks have been reduced, setbacks to common driveways have been reduced, and you've got a much greater increase in your allowable boundary wall provisions as well. Now, yes, boundary walls are a little bit more expensive to deliver, but given the infill space, we already have seen industry move to boundary walls to deliver better outcomes in those spaces as well.
So what they're saying is, look, we want more outdoor area in terms of around the alfresco, more space for a couple of trees.
Consolidated outdoor area.
Yep. We want less dead areas in the backs and sides
That's
of these
right.
units. We're going to let you build up against each other wall to wall on the boundary a lot more than we used to. Used to be obviously 9 meter distance, for example, for a wall. Or then you had to put a really stupid dog leg in the house that might have a tiny little courtyard to bedroom 2. And you go, why do I have to do this? Well, because the rules say you have to.
It needs a 4 meter gap.
Exactly,
yeah, exactly,
right? And it was not functional. No one could ever use it. Poor for draining. And what they're saying is, well, look, we'll let you get away with a lot of those things. You can build up to the boundaries, but we want that space back into the backyard of their unit.
That's exactly right. And it has a twofold effect. So in that private open space area or that primary outdoor living area, you're required to have a room for a tree. Now, it's not necessarily a tree planting per se, but you're meant to have a dedicated sort of 1.5 by 1.5 space for a tree. Now, 1.5 was actually workshopped quite heavily. Mm. It doesn't have a DSZ or a deep soil zone attached to it. It's just literally a square that's unencumbered by roof cover.
Yeah, and I think that 1.5 is practical. There are some local governments that have been enforcing over the years like 3x3s, and it's just insanity when you think about a deep soil zone. If you think about median strips, footpaths, these trees that are mature trees are living in 1x1 deep soil zones when you think about it, with their roots going underneath the brick footpath, and they haven't got a problem, but they're trying to enforce that in the backyard, and so you have to put permeable paving, or you can't have paving on the alfresco because there's this 3x3 space that can't be built in. It just wasn't practical. So to have a 1.5 meter area, I guess, is a good compromise. And then it'll come down to a local government and developers starting to understand which trees can work well within those spaces and moving towards that.
Absolutely. And I think we're going to see a lot more of the less invasive root species now. You often find a lot of landscaping packages would come with just an assortment of things that look good.
Yeah.
But 5 or 10 years from now, what are they actually doing to the building? Where I think we have a lot more consideration about what that represents. So olive trees being a classic example. Olive trees can grow straight, but if you don't prune them, they like to bush up. So there's all those thought processes about what's going to be appropriate in these spaces.
No Moreton Bay figs in our backyard.
Eucalyptus is another one. There's different types of eucalyptus. One is a torquata, I think it's called. It's got a tap root. It's great for car parks. If you want big trees in front setbacks and verges, they're probably an ideal species to use.
So when you think about the impact this is going to have on the way that builders are designing these houses for developers, having to really notch out a much bigger square or rectangle in the back corner of these blocks. Even when you bring in the concessions being made on boundary setbacks, are we still going to be seeing smaller footprints than we did last year?
I don't think so. And that's largely because we've had, from our perspective, a more of a controversial metric, which was the site cover change, which is a change to the definition of open space.
This is the biggest issue you had last year when we spoke.
Huge issue. We had a problem with the site cover metric in that I guess it was trying to consider all roofed areas as a building footprint. So irrespective of whether it was open on two sides, whether it was a veranda, it didn't matter. The roofed footprint of a building was the footprint of the building. I dare say that was to allow for a greater allowance for canopy cover to evolve. But with the increased courtyard areas and that dedicated space, I don't think we'll have that problem. So we fought fairly hard to have the definition of site cover reverted back to open space, which is the definition that we all run with now and we all know. It excludes any area open on two or more sides, excludes a veranda, porch, but also allows common property. So open space allows the proportionate share of common property. Now, that definition there is entrenched in the strata titles general regulations. So to change that definition in the R codes would go against the general regulations at another end. So it was difficult, whereas site cover excluded common property. So it could only consider the roofed area of your building on your exclusive land parcel, irrespective of whether you have common property or not.
Well, when you think about the way that this was going to impact the build parcel. So let's say there's a 120 square meter common property on a triple X block. Each of those blocks is given 40 square meters there for their open space allocation. Well, if you now can't count 40 square meters your open space, you're having to reduce at 55% for R40 of your site coverage. You're now at a point now where there goes 22 square meters of build parcel you can put on that block anymore, simply because you can't include your common property.
That's right.
That's two bedrooms.
Well, add to that as well that you now include areas like your alfresco and your veranda and your porch as part of site cover as well.
Yeah.
You can start
What's
to see
left?
How really downstairs, all you're really getting is car parking, living, kitchen, laundry, now staircase because the rest of it's going to go upstairs.
And surely the proponents of that were smoking something when they thought that was a good idea.
I'm just not convinced that the gravity of the change was as understood as it really needed
After
to
be. After 5 years. That's what frustrates me. All the conversations around, well, we worked so hard for this. It's taken so long for us to get to this point. But some clear, glaring, obvious fallacies were sitting there for everyone to see and no one to want to listen to until Minister Kerry came on board. And that's where he's had to take that decision to defer it, to have a real conversation about, well, hang on a second, what's going on here? And this is why we're in this position today, talking about what has and hasn't been revised. And I'm happy to hear from you that there has been some common sense around what that definition looks like.
Even in the face of it being gazetted, we continue to press, and we would continue to press. I mean, housing affordability is one of our number one issues, and forcing two-story outcomes, not necessarily overtly, but just by the default of the provisions, it didn't fly with us, and it didn't fly with most of our membership as well. And I'm the first to admit we did have members that were caught up in that whole transition period and deferral, much to my disappointment. But at the end of the day, I think we now have something that works better for Perth in the near foreseeable future and serves as a good template base for Part B revision if and when it actually occurs. So I think we've got a good base.
You're speaking about there's the transition here. What is that transition?
Oh, the site cover provisions haven't technically gone away. So this provision is still under 2 years of transition. And I dare say there'll be some discussions between now and when that's expected to come in as to what the need for site cover / open space means for Perth and the codes generally, because personally I'm of the firm opinion that we don't need site cover, we don't need open space.
We don't need plot ratio.
In a deemed to comply outcome, so for example, if you've got a deemed to comply provision that talks to setbacks, courtyard areas, boundary wall provisions, all those kinds of things, effectively mandating the footprint of the building.
That's enough control.
That is enough control. But if you then go and vary that provision, then we start talking about open space slash site cover slash whatever that metric ends up being, because that's now performance provision. So at least it puts a limit on footprint somehow in a way that makes sense.
What are the things that universally we all agree are great about this gazettal and this medium density code that we're calling Part C now that we should be looking forward to, where possibly in the past we've discounted them as even opportunities because it wasn't possible? What will you signpost to developers to go, well, look, guys, I know this is a bit of a change, but really you should look into this and this and this as a great opportunity?
There's a number of these sitting within the code, and this is real kudos to the folks at Department of Planning, especially the Design WA team, for their understanding of dwelling diversity and some of those mechanisms that drive it. So if we think back to the existing code as it was, to develop something like over 55's development, you not only had a notification on title that was very restrictive for lending provisions, but you also had to develop a minimum of 5 in any one development.
Mm.
Now, that harks back to a long time ago when, to develop this kind of as-needed product, we had state-run care. We didn't have the NDIS. So it was easy for places like Silver Chain and other state organisations to visit sites because they could just go out and see 5 in one hit.
Mm.
That was part of that original conversation there.
Makes sense.
Absolutely. But now we don't have that state-based issue. Now we don't have those clusters, I guess, and we want to integrate people. We don't want to lock people away. No one wants that. The idea is now is that the need for over 55s is now moved to universal dwellings. Now, that is, it's a modified, effectively, silver level in livable housing design guidelines. It's not the same, I'm going to point this one out, but if you follow that as a deemed to comply outcome, then you can get a 35% lot size concession with no notification on title. So if you deliver universally accessible dwellings, then you get that lot size concession.
This sounds massive. All you have to do is develop a product at a universally accessible level, and now you can turn a triplex site into a quad site.
That's right. So the provisions of the appendix really mix gold and a bit of silver and kind of thing. But you're also allowed to just have a look at having a livable housing assessor, I think they're called, look at the plans as well and confirm that it meets a particular standard.
And I can still sell it to a 25-year-old.
Absolutely. And the point is that many people who want this kind of housing are building before they physically need it. They know they're going to need it in future, but before they physically need it, and it opens up those windows.
Well, it's just building out the market. So it might first go to a 25-year-old. They will then upsize in 5 years and sell it to someone who actually needs it at that point in time, who might be 60 years old.
That's right. But the incentive is there for the 35% lot size concession. Now, there are limits to the numbers of concession you can take, and that's perfectly fine. But for example, if you're doing a triplex can suddenly become a 4-unit site by delivering a couple of universally accessible dwellings.
I think everyone should be looking into that. It doesn't cost that much more to make them universally accessible. It's like the wider hallways, a little bit of a change to the way we set up our kitchen.
Bigger doors, bigger wet areas.
Yeah, and our wet areas. Other than that, we're essentially delivering very similar product, right?
Absolutely.
And suddenly we've got ourselves a bonus there on what we can deliver. Yep. As long as there's an actual profit to building in the first place,
that's a good point.
Then it makes sense, right? And that's one of the issues we've still got in this market, is that in a lot of suburbs, it still doesn't stack up to do the build. And given that it's based on the DA, I assume, it would be a built strata development that you could then turn into survey strata. You can't go on and just say, oh, look, we're going to do universally accessible level development. Can we survey strata it straight away? I assume the cart can't come before the horse here.
We already see this at the moment with the single dwelling provisions. I'm sure you've seen some people marketing much smaller lots. But the thing is that who's approved the subdivision, or who's aware of the subdivision, the local government, who's now accepting the one or the two developments on that lot, the local government. So I'm sure they'd have a flag on those lots as to the ones they've approved for concessional size product. You talk about affordability, there is another angle to this as well. So small dwellings, that's up to 70 square meters of footprint, work really well in some of the areas that are oversubscribed with 4x2s and 3x2s. So one of the great things I was taught at a very young age in property development was somewhere like Canning Vale, where it's all 4x2s, has a dire need for one bedders and two bedders, because that's all people... There's none of it there. So it's a market niche. So there's a 35% lot size concession for providing small dwellings on their own title. So what you're looking at effectively is an ancillary dwelling with its own title.
A granny flat with its own title.
Yeah, effectively. But it's not an ancillary dwelling. And that's the difference here is that ancillary dwellings, there's a lot of news around that at the moment. I'm happy to talk to it later. But small dwellings are allowed to be titled and sold individually with, again, without the title restriction, without the minimum numbers. It's a small dwelling.
I would have thought this would apply best to suburbs where properties can access a rear laneway. I can't imagine myself, to be frank, many properties in Canning Vale where the houses are massive. They sit across the width of a block most of the time with no rear access. And there's a pool at the back and a gazebo. To be able to fit a 70 square meter lot in there and still have any access through the side of the house. So surely suburbs like Doubleview and Scarborough are probably getting a lot of a look in there.
Absolutely. That's really where it is more appropriate. But you do see areas in, I wouldn't call them fringe suburbs anymore, but at one time I guess they were. Canning Vale Town Centre has a lot of very tightly zoned product that would be very appropriate for small dwellings to consider. And the thing is that there's no limit to what a small dwelling is other than the realistic sizes of spaces. So you could be developing a row of studio style townhouses up to a row of two bed, 70 square metre, 2x1 product. So a great example of this would be something like your under duplex size zoning at, say, R50, R40, or even R30, where previously you couldn't subdivide the rear of these blocks or there's a bit of space out the side or those kind of things. So now with that 35% lot size concession, you can actually unlock these blocks that probably weren't developable by any means previously, and now you can get that 35% lot size concession as long as the small dwelling that goes on it isn't any bigger than a 70 square meter footprint. So the lot size varies, as you know, from the tables and the minimum and average lot sizes. It's 35% against that in the same way that it used to be the 1/3 lot size concession for single beds and over 55s.
What are we fitting on a 70 square meter parcel here? Is it a 2x2 with a carport?
Yeah, so the 70 square meters is only the internal footprint of the dwelling. So things like carports, verandas, alfrescos all sit beyond that. So we're really talking about the footprint of the building. Now, you and I both know you can get a 2x1 very comfortably inside 70 square meters. And the idea was really, harking back to some of the very early discussions we had, was to start bringing about more of the two-bed villa product that seems to just have disappeared from the market entirely.
It does seem that most of that one and two-bed space from a land point of view has just been replaced by the triplex 3x2 with a double garage. And there's obviously enough of them around. What this does open up is an opportunity for someone who is single, has a little dog or a cat, doesn't need a three-bedroom house, is happy with a 2x2 for the grandkids to come over at a certain point, and therefore is accessing a much cheaper housing type because the land portion is smaller and the build cost is obviously a lot smaller.
That's right.
Suddenly, instead of that entry level in Warwick of 600 grand now, it could be a 400, for example, for a small lot. What it also does is it unlocks a lot of blocks, I believe, where maybe the zoning was there for the block itself to be subdivided into two or three, but the existing house is massive and there's only maybe 200 square meters left at the back. And you go, well, the only way I could have subdivided this property is if I knock the house down. I don't want to knock the house down. It's a fantastic house. Well, here's an opportunity now where that block that you may have needed 260 at the back, now it can be, you know, 180 square meters, something like that, for example. And you put that 70 square meter small house on there, everyone's winning. There is no demolition or destruction of value of the front house.
Exactly. It's about improving affordable and diverse dwelling outcomes. And I think dwelling diversity breeds affordability by default. So this is a really forward-thinking concession policy.
This was the best bit about this, in my opinion, that everyone agreed on in the first place. Are there any other good ones?
Ancillary dwellings is actually a really good nugget. And
explain the difference for us. Small dwelling, ancillary dwelling, what's the difference?
Okay, so small dwelling has the same footprint size as an ancillary dwelling. A small dwelling can be separately titled. An ancillary dwelling is exactly that. It's ancillary to the single house that it's attached to. Now, that's the existing definitions currently.
The granny flat,
that's right. Yep. It's called an ancillary dwelling because
so you sell it with the house.
You sell it with the house. You can't separately title it.
Yep.
Now, the existing definition is that it's attached to a single house, and that single house has to be on a lot over 350 square meters. What we're looking at now is an ancillary dwelling can be part of a single house or a grouped dwelling, and there's no minimum lot size for its provision. So as long as you meet certain outcomes within the code and that's prescribed and you don't infringe on the dwelling that it's attached to's provisions for things like site cover / open space, courtyard areas, setbacks, etc., then if you can fit it, you can have it.
So example here, we've got an old side-by-side duplex pair that's split down the middle via a fence, and there's a common roof over these two houses, right?
Yep.
You could theoretically go and put a granny flat at the back of both of these.
That's right.
Duplex pairs. No issues. It's not a new title. Simply saying, yep, there's no problems. If both of you, for example, wanted a granny flat, go for it. No one's going to stop you anymore.
That's right. In fact, I did an example like that in Fremantle many years ago. We had a duplex half. Both were one by ones, and we put 2x1s at the back as the ancillary dwellings. So yeah, the model exists for sure. Another good one though is if you think about a triplex, for example, you could do a Fonzie flat above every single garage as part of a standard triplex. So that turns every single group dwelling and single house into a dual key, a genuine dual key property.
So you can dual key your triplex unit.
Absolutely.
By doing a second story extension and saying, well, this is a different dual key unit now.
That's right.
I mean, you can't sell it separately, but you could rent it separately.
Subject to fire provisions within the NCC, absolutely. I think it's one of the bigger game changers that's hiding in this. Everyone sort of said, oh, it's great that they've been now expanded out of the medium density code or Part C, and that provision is now allowed in Part B as well. So anything from R2, which is your farmhouse, all the way up to now R40 single houses or R25 under single houses or group dwellings, you can now do that across the whole of Perth.
You travel to places like Croatia. I would see a lot of houses there that are on Airbnb, for example, where it's a 2 or 3 story house. It's one house connected internally, but also each level is accessible externally through an external stairwell where you could block these levels off if you wanted to. You essentially can be doing that now. You could create an Airbnb flat on top of your house. I can imagine companies setting themselves up here going, look, we are a prefab 2-story home improvement company. Where it could be, for example, simply just making your owner-occupied property bigger, but also we offer a product where the access to this second story is external as well through an external stairway, and now we've got a rentable Airbnb product on top of you on your second floor. Make a dollar out of turning your one-story property into a 2-story property. Do you need the approval of the other properties in the survey strata scheme?
That's to be debated at the moment. If it's a build strata, as in the building footprint is captured, but as far as I'm aware, if you're just planning it out from scratch, it's not a problem. And I guess the great thing about it as well is that the flexibility of, and you talk about short stay and the idea that you might be able to, I don't know, have multi-generational families in there or that kind of thing, that flexibility remains with the homeowner. So if the homeowner needs additional space because, I don't know, their kids have come back from overseas and need somewhere to rent, well, hey, come live with us, live above the garage. Alternatively, mum's come home, you know, mum's before her last move sort of thing, right? Like dad's died or something along those lines. Mum can move into the main house and you can move into the ancillary dwelling while mum just...
Aren't you a good son?
These are the things that keep society together.
And yeah, I think and by you haven't been able to do that until
dwelling
now.
Diversity breeds affordability. There's no other way to it.
Well, there it is, guys. Business idea for anyone listening. You can use these new provisions to put an Airbnb on top of your current one-story house.
And you can send checks to me direct. It's fine.
Aaron Sice will put his bank details up. Any others, mate?
Yeah, planning reform is huge. That's been announced the past couple of days as well. Single houses are really interesting now. There's been a bit of a change in scope to approvals for them. Now, if they require a planning assessment, they only need to be assessed by a delegated authority.
So the councillors keep their grubby hands out of it, is what you're saying?
Well, it can't be referred to council for decision is really the issue here.
That's how it should be. It should stay with the professionals that have gone through university.
I've got to be honest, I know a lot of planners and I trust their judgment a lot more. And I think that we're talking about some of the most lowest risk and most simple buildings that exist. I don't think it's too much to suggest that people with skill and experience assess them and make a call on whether it meets the design principles or not. So that's actually shaved probably 30 days off an assessment period if you are tripped into that space.
And it's also providing a level of confidence to planning professionals that they're not going to have their asses whipped or they're not going to have their decisioning second-guessed by a council who's just politically driven. It gives them agency, it gives them control and confidence to do their job properly. I've seen it too often now where clearly that local government planner was in two minds as to which way to go on an application because they were concerned or scared about the backlash from a council.
I agree. So that was actually part of our issues paper, HA's issue paper, that we released to government at this time last year. So for that to get traction so quickly is really welcome. There's also an online tracking portal for development applications. That's fantastic. I think everyone's been sort of looking for some sort of understanding about when things go into the system, how it's progressing and where it sits, rather than having to call an officer and talk to the officer on duty or whatever it is and get a standard pro forma response. We've also got a number of dApps have been stripped out of the system now. So now we've reduced the number from, I think it was 5 now, to 3.
Good idea. Consolidating
consistency,
this.
Consistency.
But one thing I've seen, given we've been across every dApp in WA, is the lack of consistency on these dApps. Some dApps are fantastic. They're pragmatic, they're knowledgeable, they understand the not only the application but the local area and obviously the planning environment in the first place. Some I've found deplorable, a lack of understanding of the application, let alone a lack of understanding of the actual planning regime, and really just seem to be going with the flow on everyone else. That's not what we're paying them for.
No one wants that.
So hopefully consolidating this into a small number of highly regarded professionals who hopefully take up this job as a vocation, to be frank, rather than a second income stream, is something that I hope will really add more confidence to developers to actually get things done.
Yeah, and it's funny you talk about confidence for developers. So we also have that state significant development pathway, which is determined by the WAPC for projects over the value of 20 mil. That's an option there as well. It is an expensive pathway though. Like, it's not just something,
What are we paying?
I dare say it's probably got six figures attached to it.
100 grand's rounding numbers to a $50 million project.
If you think about like ECU,
we think about time. Right, time value, 100 grand is a mortgage repayment on some of these properties.
I think it's good to have a more expedited process for those really.
At the end of the day, it's an option. It's not.
It's an option. It's not mandatory. Yeah. That's exactly. But talking about options, funny you raise that. Also part of our issues paper that went to the government in this time last year was that dApps can now accept single tier strata scheme applications. So in other words, group dwellings over the value of 2 mil.
That's a lot of projects these days with build costs.
With build costs, it's huge. But if you've got 4 two-stories, you're basically in there. So that's most Netherlands products. That's probably most.
Any reason you're saying Netherlands?
No. I'm just thinking like places where 2 stories stack up.
Yeah.
If you've got an amalgamated site somewhere like Kubi, where you've got 2 triplexes side by side,
yep,
and a central driveway, that'd be 2 mil every day.
If we're amalgamating to 3 dApps, have we got the manpower here, given the tsunami of applications I think that are going to go towards the dApps rather than the local governments?
That is part of the concern, and I was mindful of that when I was putting it in, because effectively they still have to do all the assessments as part of an RAR, which is a responsible authority report. So
local governments still have their say. It goes to the DAP as to whether the DAP agrees with that or not.
I think at the end of the day, again, it's an option, it's an opt-in, it's not mandatory. So I think most developers would take it up if you're seeking a lot of design principles and you're not going to end up in front of elected members.
To be frank, I think the best way to approach this as a developer, if you have a project that's going to be over $2 million in cost, is simply to suss this out with the city. Speak to the planning officers to get a feel for whether they're supportive or not. You're going to really notice very quickly whether they're going to help you get this thing approved or get in your way because they don't agree with it. If you don't think you got a lot of support from the city, well, then the DAP is for you.
Yeah, and I think it's important to remember as well that we are talking about group dwellings. So odds are if you've got a development that's over $2 million, you're more than likely under the Part C provisions as well. So you'll be under that modified R codes.
Aaron Sice, thank you so much for coming in today, mate. The nerdy discussion, I assume, is going to be a bit tough to consume for some people, but if you break it down, take your time listening to it, it really does have an impact on every single developer in Western Australia these days in that medium density space, which is exactly where we need them putting their time, effort and money right now.
Time, effort and money, please. Dwelling diversity, and give us lots of them.
Yeah, from a granny flat all the way up to our infill apartment developments that we're still not seeing come out on the ground anytime soon. It might
that's
be a moot
that's
point.
That's a whole nother discussion.
Exactly right. We plan for all this stuff and none of it stacks up anyway at the moment. So hopefully at some point in time, we do find that confluence point where it does, and at least we will understand the planning policy changes thanks to your assistance today.
Thanks, mate.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Perth Property Show. If you've only just joined the conversation, you can catch up by heading over to our website, perthpropertyshow.com.au, subscribing to the podcast, or joining our Facebook page. Don't forget to tune in next Monday at 7 a.m. for more expert insights, local analysis, and suburb spotlights. Happy hunting!